Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We will get started in just a few minutes. All right, I think we can go ahead and get started. Hello, everyone. My name is Paul Bierman. I'm the Director of Education and Events for SNEB. Welcome to today's Journal of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior Journal Club webinar, part of a series of 11 webinars with a focus on nutrition education programs and implications from the field. A special thank you to the SNEB Food and Nutrition Extension Education Division for from the journal showcasing the work of cooperative extension nutrition educators. As the official peer-reviewed journal of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior, JNEB advances nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. Before we begin, I have a few pieces of information to review. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. Throughout the presentation, please type any questions you may have into the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen, and they will be moderated out to our panelists. When the webinar ends today, you will be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to complete this, as your feedback is greatly appreciated for future SNEB webinars. This webinar is being recorded and will be available free of charge to SNEB members in the webinars section of the website. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent in the next few days, which will include a link to the recording for this session, the handouts, and your CEU certificate for your attendance today. I will now hand things over to our moderator and the organizer of the Journal Club, Dr. Kristen DiFilippo, Teaching Assistant Professor at the University of Illinois. Kristen?
Thank you, Paul. We have three presenters today, and I want to thank them for being with us today and sharing their work. Sarah Stutz is a registered dietitian nutritionist and certified diabetes educator. She is an assistant professor at Colorado State University in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. Her research focuses on addressing food and nutrition insecurity as it impacts adults with nutrition-related chronic disease, such as diabetes, with an emphasis on health disparities, social determinants of health, nutrition education, and multi-level approaches to chronic disease management and prevention. Angela Brega is an associate professor with the Center for American Indian and Alaska Native Health in the Colorado School of Public Health. Dr. Brega's research focuses on understanding and addressing the vast health disparities that affect Native populations, with emphasis on type 2 diabetes. She co-directs the NIH-funded Center for American Indian and Alaska Native Diabetes Translation Research, which aims to expand diabetes translation research focusing on Native populations. Dr. Brega has led or collaborated on development of several interventions to improve management of diabetes, including What Can I Eat? Diabetes Nutrition Education Program for American Indian and Alaska Native Adults with Type 2 Diabetes. Kelly Wilson Begay comes from the Kickapoo, Seminole, and Muscogee Creek people, tribal nations now located in Oklahoma. Kelly's lived experience and background as a registered dietitian, public health advocate, nutrition educator, and entrepreneur have allowed her to reach Indigenous communities in multiple ways. Throughout her career, Kelly has addressed nutrition and public health issues affecting Native people and has an in-depth understanding of the unique qualities and complex challenges with Indian country. Through her business, Maven Collective Consulting, Kelly connects with clients, programs, and partners to foster strategies that are grounded in Native lifeways and values, and strives to ensure her life's work honor her ancestors. I want to thank the three of them for presenting, and at this time, I can pass it to them. If you have questions while they are presenting, please type those in the Q&A box.
Great. Thank you so much, Kristen. So we're going to kind of tag team here, and Kelly has the slides. So I'll go ahead and have you go to the next slide, please, Kelly. All right, and these are the learning objectives that we'll go through today by the end of this webinar. You have the slides, so you'll be able to read those. Go on to the next slide, please. These are the nutrition educator competencies as required by this JNEB webinar series, so that you can use them to fill out your CEU at the end of this presentation. Next slide, please. And this is us. Kristen already did a great job of introducing us, so I'm just gonna let each of us kind of introduce ourselves again as we need to, as we start our sections. And then the next slide. And our disclosures as required again by the JNEB webinar series. And then this slide is, we just don't wanna wait till the very end to make sure that we share our gratitude and appreciation for those that collaborate with us on the projects that we'll talk about today. Certainly Angela, Kelly, and I are part of a larger team, some of whom are at the sites where we've conducted some of our research. Some of them are here in Colorado with us, and certainly also want to thank the project lead, Dr. Kelly Moore, who has since retired, and also all of our funders, which includes ADA, NIH, and the Shakopee Midwakaton Sioux community, who have funded these efforts that we're gonna talk about today. Next slide. And I think that goes to you, Kelly.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Yeah, so thanks everyone. I wanted to start off our conversation just talking a little bit more about who we're talking about and who we've worked with on this project. For those of you who aren't familiar working in tribal communities, there are 9.7 million American Indian and Alaska Native people in the United States. Another kind of little known fact is that the majority of them, so 7 out of 10, or 70% live in urban areas. And I think that's something to keep in mind. A lot of times in our communities, you have Native people who are living actually in both areas. So they may be working and commuting to an urban area throughout the week. And on the weekends, they may be going back home to where, you know, their families are, where their homelands are. Sometimes that is a reservation. And so they're living in basically two places. But just for the context of our conversation, you'll find that we did work in a variety of areas through this project. Another kind of just point of information here is that there are 574 federally recognized tribal nations across 37 states. And I always want to give a shout out to Alaska because over 250 of these tribes are in Alaska alone. And, you know, aside from the federally recognized tribes that are listed here, there are also state recognized tribes, and they're not included in this 574. So all that to say is that there are many, many different tribes who are all very different. They're different in their cultures, in their languages, and especially in the food that, you know, that they eat. A lot of the foods are regionally based. And, you know, just something, again, to keep in mind. And really, I would encourage you to find out which tribes are in the areas where you're located. Just so you're for your own understanding, and especially if you want to work with this population, it's really important to have that knowledge base. I mentioned earlier that, you know, we do have different tribal foods and native food ways, again, with so many different tribes and, again, cultures and traditions and ceremonies. There's a lot of diversity throughout throughout tribal nations. Where we live, our access to land and water is all very different as well. I think, you know, my tribe that I'm enrolled in, which is the Kickapoo tribe of Oklahoma, originated in around the Wisconsin, Illinois, which are states now, you know, originated there, and were relocated to different parts of the United States. And so, you know, my tribe's original dwellings and homeland is more in a woodlands kind of area. And because of that relocation from, you know, our original homelands to a different place, there are some of that traditional food ways that are no longer accessible to my people. And so with that comes a lot of the disparities that we see now related to health and related to access to different kinds of original ancestral foods. So there are, you know, the importance of our language and our traditional teachings and ceremony are still very strong and still there. But it is a lot harder to be honest, especially if you're relocated. And the things that we're holding on to and really working and strengthening is our tribal food sovereignty. So the ability to raise, to harvest, grow and share our original food ways is very important to our culture and the way that we work with our tribe and then also other tribes in our areas. Just, you know, a little bit more about Indigenous food facilitators. There are many different ways that our communities are being connected to various traditional foods. And, you know, we are, you know, looking at and working with these different facilitators, you know, from grant programming to clinics and hospitals, to researchers, to our community members, our elders and our youth are huge in this effort, as well as our policymakers and other programs who are really strengthening our Indigenous foods, foodways. And, you know, I mentioned earlier about some of the disparities that have come from the relocation and different really traumatic events that happened in the past are still very prevalent today and affecting us in different ways today, especially as it relates to diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And our population has the highest burden of diabetes and comorbidities in the United States, which is one reason why this program and this curriculum and project is very important. And then also that our population has just a greater risk of mortality due to diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So one way that our different communities and our partners have and healthcare providers have worked together is through nutrition education and diabetes self-management support. These are really important ways that we can help mitigate type 2 diabetes and help our communities be healthier and just manage diabetes. And so there is a, what we know, there is a need for a culturally tailored diabetes nutrition education. We know that many of the nutrition education that currently exists is not tailored to our population, and that You know, really, we want to see people who look like us in some of these materials. And it's not just the pictures, but it's also the understanding of some of the challenges and where they're rooted from and how we got to where we are. And so really, you know, showing that just even some of the situational examples that are in curriculum is really important to make sure that it connects to our communities, especially as it relates to foods. And we know how important that is for diabetes nutrition education.
Okay, thank you so much, Kelly. So I'm Angela Braga. I'm from the Centers for American Indian and Alaska Native Health at the University of Colorado. And I've been working with Sarah and Kelly for a long time on interventions designed to try to reduce some of those vast diabetes disparities we see in Native populations. And the work we're really here to tell you about today has to do with the What Can I Eat Diabetes Nutrition Education Program, and specifically about our adaptation of that existing program to make it culturally tailored for American Indian and Alaska Native populations. Next slide, please, Kelly. Thank you. So the What Can I Eat Healthy Choices for People with Type 2 Diabetes curriculum was developed by the American Diabetes Association with the goal of ensuring that communities that are heavily impacted by type 2 diabetes have access to accurate nutrition education. Now, in recognition that American Indian and Alaska Native populations have very high rates of type 2 diabetes and also have very limited access to culturally tailored nutrition education programs, the American Diabetes Association collaborated with the Shakopee Midwakaton Sioux community of Minnesota to fund the development of a version of the What Can I Eat curriculum that is specifically tailored to Native audiences. And the three of us were very lucky and honored to be among the research team that was the recipient of the funding to support development of that culturally adapted program. Next slide, please. Thank you. So this slide provides an overview of the project through which we adapted and tested this culturally tailored version of the What Can I Eat curriculum. I'll give you a quick overview here because we're going to tell you about each of these steps in more detail as we go here today. So in year one, we very fortunately had the time to conduct an extensive needs assessment to understand the needs and the preferences of Native communities with regard to diabetes nutrition education. So that was really the focus of our work in year one, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. In year two, we used what we learned from the needs assessment to help us refine the existing What Can I Eat curriculum, which was not, you know, tailored to Native communities, so that we could build a curriculum that really is focusing on the needs and the assets of Native communities. In year three, we conducted a pilot test to determine the impact of the adapted curriculum on Native people with type 2 diabetes. The paper that we're invited to talk about here today summarizes some of our qualitative research that was part of that pilot test. So we'll be telling you more about that in a minute. But we wanted to give you a sense of how we got to that set of analyses and also where we've been going since then. So then in years 4 to 6, we have been doing additional testing with the curriculum and have been trying to refine and improve it a little bit as well, including adding some new food insecurity resources and really planning for larger scale testing. Next slide, please. Okay, so I mentioned that in year one, we conducted a very extensive needs assessment. We began that with a literature review aimed at identifying research and intervention work that had already been done related to diabetes nutrition education in Native populations. We also did a lot of qualitative research. So we conducted focus groups with American Indian and Alaska Native adults who had type 2 diabetes and also their family members to get a sense from them about what is it like to really live with diabetes in Native communities and to try to eat in a healthy way with type 2 diabetes. We also conducted interviews with community-based key informants, for example, local diabetes educators who are living in Native communities and working with Native communities, and also interviewed national experts on diabetes nutrition with a specific focus on Native populations. We also conducted a health literacy review of the existing curriculum to really get a sense of whether the curriculum itself and the materials related to it were designed in a way that would be really easy for all adults to understand and to take action based on. We also looked at the existing curriculum from a graphic design perspective. So if we're to, you know, going to take this existing intervention and make it really visually appropriate for Native populations, what are the kinds of changes we might make? We then summarized our findings from all of those activities and provided a recommendation report to the ADA and the Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community of Minnesota. And they gave us the green light to go ahead and use those recommendations to actually create a culturally adapted version of the curriculum. Next slide, please, Kelly. Thank you. So this slide just shows you during our community needs assessment, the folks we were working with to conduct that qualitative work. So we did interviews in four different communities. I'm going to close this little chat that popped up in front of my slide. So there were four different communities we worked with in conducting interviews and focus groups with our community partners. Kelly told you a little bit about just how diverse the American Indian and Alaska Native population is. So four sites certainly doesn't give us, you know, a picture of what the experience of all Native people is. But these four sites across the country did give us the ability to receive a variety of different, you know, inputs from people in different tribal groups, different regions of the country, et cetera. So that diversity was helpful to us. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks, Angela. Yeah, so we were able to focus a whole year on this needs assessment and really finding out what's needed. And so some of the things that we heard, which we've already heard today, is that there are so many vast differences between regions, tribes, you know, urban versus rural, and that those, you know, need to be accommodated regarding traditional foods and barriers to healthy eating. And then also just the education resources, the needs and barriers to healthy eating vary across different stages of life between Native adults and in urban and rural settings. And so what we did was, or the recommendation was, to develop more than five lessons to, so the facilitator can really tailor what lessons apply to their situation or their community or the needs of their class. And then also include placeholders for sites and facilitators to tailor to their cultural needs. So just like I mentioned how, you know, each region has different foods that are important to them, having a placeholder or flexibility in this curriculum for facilitators to really tailor it to their region and to the tribes they're working with was really important to those we talked with. Another recommendation was to include examples of these traditional foods and the history of traditional foods and how they can be included in modern diets, modern day diets, inviting extended family and support to classes. So having that community, having that support person with them is really important. Another thing, you know, when related to that is when you are recommending or allowing a support person, that you'd not limit it to a spouse or a partner. It may be their cousin, it may be their auntie that comes with them as their support person. And then also including time for discussion. That's huge. And, you know, we know that in our communities, learning from one another, learning from your peers, and having that time to discuss and really share is really important as well. And I think what really makes this program successful. Some of the other things is, the social norms and traditions. So, you know, food is important in social gatherings and celebrations. It's a huge part of our culture and our community. Gatherings and events happen frequently. So being able to provide the tools that someone might need when they're in those types of situations is also another key to the curriculum in this program. Also understanding and knowing that there are barriers to healthful eating. So it could be their how close they are to a store, how close they are to healthy produce or healthy foods, the high cost of healthy foods, really just looking at all the different things that might be in someone's world as far as a barrier or a challenge to healthful eating, and making sure that they're addressed, or that, you know, of the lessons that are provided, that like we mentioned earlier, how facilitators can choose what's especially important to their class or the people they're serving, but having lessons that address these barriers. Another is that, you know, again, more topics related to these barriers. So food resource management, use of commodity foods and healthful meals. And what that means by commodity foods are foods that are offered through the FDPIR program, which is a government, federal government program that's available to some Native people. They have to qualify just like someone would for SNAP. So those are foods that have kind of been around in our communities for a very long time, but being able to address how commodity foods can be worked into healthful meals is really important as well. And then also the class format. So, you know, the educator, them being a part of the community and building that trust that our community members need with someone who's working with them, who's coaching them, who's teaching them, is really important as well. It was important for educators to feel confident in what they were sharing. So the curriculum has a scripted format for them to be able to have that confidence and actually be able to make it so that a non-RD could teach these classes. Because again, having someone from the community, a peer again, is really important to teach each other. And so having the tools and the curriculum for someone to do that was key. Sorry, I'm still going here. All right, so the program development. So based on the findings, the literature review, the assessment, we were able to work with our team members to develop the program partnering with different experts related to curriculum development, and really made it to what we have today. So some of this is just the breakdown of the different class topics, what they're focused on, the different ways that physical activity and mindful nutrition activity were worked into these lessons. And then also just some of the unique features of the curriculum is that community members, real community members modeled for the photos that wasn't stock photos that you might see over and over again in some of the curriculum. These were original photos of real people in the community. There are scripted lessons. Again, we know the importance of that. Oops, sorry. How to teach, what can I eat? So an intro section for to the facilitator guide, the emphasis on traditional foods, peer-to-peer learning opportunities, you know, the opportunity to share with one another, community and family-based, so allowing that support person to come with them to a class. And then also a really, I think, unique and cool feature is that there's an arts-based learning activities. Our people and for the most part are very visual and hands-on. And so having that component in the curriculum was really impactful.
Okay, thank you so much, Kelly. Kelly, I think our slides are maybe a little too small for folks, so we wanted to try to show the PDF. So Kelly, if you will unshare, Sarah has got the PDF open and she can share that.
Okay, Angela, you'll have to tell me if this is better. Is the resolution better? Can y'all see the PDF? Anyone give a thumbs up?
Yeah, we've already gotten a thumbs up. Thank you so much, Kitty. I appreciate that.
Okay, thanks for that feedback, Kitty. Yeah, and Angela, I'll let me just practice going to the next slide before you start. Did that change for y'all?
It did.
Okay, got it. Okay, I'll stop talking now. Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And thank you, Kelly, for sharing kind of the big findings of the need assessment with us. Okay, so we're back to our project overview slide here. We've told you a bit about the needs assessment and what we learned from it, and then how we developed a culturally adapted version of the What Can I Eat curriculum based on that. And now we want to tell you a bit about the pilot test of the adapted curriculum that is designed for Native people. Next slide, please, Sarah. Thank you. So here again, we're showing you who our community partners are in this process. So we conducted the pilot test at 5 different clinical sites in that all serve Native populations. It includes the 4 sites that were part of our community needs assessment process, in addition to the Cherokee Indian Hospital that joined us during the pilot test. Again, there's some, huge diversity in the Native population in the United States, but we do have some diversity available across these groups where we're in different kinds of clinical sites in different parts of the country, representing different tribal groups. And so we do have, you know, some diversity in the folks participating here, which was a benefit to us. Next slide, please, Sarah. Thank you. Okay, so our pilot test was a randomized controlled trial that used a waitlist design. What that means is that all participants eventually received the intervention, meaning the adapted What Can I Eat curriculum, but some people received that intervention right away after they were enrolled, and some of them received it several months after enrollment, which allowed us to have a group that was in the intervention at the same time that we had a group that was not yet receiving it. So we had a kind of a control group there. So I'll just walk you kind of quickly through the flow chart here. So everybody started by being, having their study participation discussed with them, explained to them, and so they could decide whether they wanted to be part of the project. After folks consented to participate, we collected baseline data for everybody. That was both survey data and clinical data. We'll tell you about what that included in a minute. After that baseline data collection, we randomized people either to be in the immediate intervention group or the waitlist group. If you were randomized to the immediate intervention group, you went straight into What Can I Eat classes. So once a week for the next 4 weeks, you would go to a class each week. as part of the What Can I Eat curriculum. At the end of class four, we collected data again. That is, we refer to that as the 1 month data. And I'll tell you about some results for 1 month data later. And then folks came back 2 months later and they had the final fifth class of the curriculum. And we collected data after that as well. Now, if you'd been randomized to the waitlist group, you would collect data at 1 month and 3 months, just like the immediate intervention group did. But at that point, you in the waitlist group have still not actually engaged in the What Can I Eat classes. So there's still a control group. And then after 3 months is when that waitlist group begins the intervention. I won't tell you the details of that now because I won't be presenting any data from those later time points right now. But I just wanted to make sure that it's clear, although everyone eventually gets the intervention, the immediate group gets it right away, and the waitlist group at 1 month and 3 months have still not started the intervention. Okay, next slide, Sarah. Thank you. One of the things we wanted to share with you is that our project was very strongly impacted by COVID. We were actually just starting the pilot tests at the beginning of 2020 when the COVID pandemic began. So the project was immediately shut down and we had to revamp how we were doing everything. So to follow the safety protocols that were established both by our institutional review boards and those clinical sites we were working with, we had to make the project completely touch-free. So nothing could be in person basically. So that meant that we had to transition the What Can I Eat curriculum from being an in-person curriculum to being entirely done virtually. So we taught the classes by Zoom. We also had to eliminate any visits to the clinics that would only be for research purposes. So instead of having people come to the clinic to collect clinical data or to complete surveys, we had to find a way to collect those data without them ever coming in person to the clinic. So what we ended up doing is sending the surveys to them and they completed them at home and sent them back to us. And we also sent them equipment that would allow them to collect the clinical data at home. So we sent everybody a body weight scale, A1C home tests and blood pressure monitors so that they could collect all their clinical indicators and send those data to us. After we got everything redesigned, we were able to restart the pilot test at the beginning of 2021 and are able to tell you now about the results of that pilot testing. Sarah, next slide, please. Thank you. So these are the measures that we collected. I mentioned that participants completed a survey. That survey was collected at every data collection time point for everybody. There were demographic questions in that survey. There were also questions that allow us to understand diabetes-related self-efficacy and behavior. Now, self-efficacy is a very important concept in behavior change research. It represents people's confidence that they can engage in certain behaviors. And we know that if people don't feel confident that they can engage in a behavior, they're much less likely to do it. So when you're doing a behavior change intervention, you really want to try to build that confidence that people can engage in the behaviors you're encouraging. So we have a set of items that allow us to measure people's confidence about their ability to engage in specific diabetes-related nutrition behaviors and physical activity. And we also actually measure the degree to which they engage in those behaviors. I mentioned that folks measure their weight, their blood pressure, and their A1C. Those are all clinical indicators that we measured as part of the impact analysis. And then we also really wanted to know what the experience of engaging in this intervention was like for people. So at the conclusion of every class, our participants filled out a written survey related to their experience in the class. And when people completed all five classes, we brought them in for focus groups to really learn in much more detail and nuance what the experience of participating in the American Indian Alaska Native What Can I Eat program was like for them. Okay, next slide. Okay, thank you. So we wanted to share some of the key findings regarding the impact of the curriculum on the participants who were able to be part of our classes. And what I'm gonna share with you here tells us a bit about how participants changed from baseline before they were involved in the intervention to 1 month and 3 months. So again, reminding you that the immediate intervention group were actively involved in the intervention at 1 month and 3 months, whereas the folks in the waitlist group had not started the intervention yet. So we're able to see, you know, how did the intervention impact the folks who were actually actively in it, and how did people change who had not started it yet? So what we see is some really important changes from baseline to 1 month and 3 months. So for folks who were in the immediate intervention group, we see that their confidence that they can use the diabetes plate to, you know, manage the way they are eating increased substantially from baseline to both 1 month and 3 months. We also see that they expressed much more confidence that they could engage in healthy nutrition choices, both at 1 month and 3 months. We saw changes in actual nutrition behavior, such that people were engaging in healthier behaviors more frequently at 1 month and 3 months for those folks who were engaged in the intervention. And then we saw an improvement in physical activity at 1 month for those who were in the immediate intervention. And I will say that although that change was not significant at 3 months, it was very close. So probably with a bigger sample, we might have seen a significant improvement in physical activity at the 3 month time point also. But for sure, we had seen that improvement by 1 month. And then compared to baseline, the waitlist intervention group showed improvement in one of those indicators. So they showed greater confidence in making healthy nutrition choices at the 3 month time point, but that was a smaller change than we saw in the other groups. So understandably, we see a lot of change in self-efficacy and health, nutrition behavior and physical activity in the intervention group that is immediately getting the intervention, and saw very few changes in the waitlist group who had not yet started the intervention. Next slide, please. And I'll turn it over to Sarah now.
All right, thanks, guys. So now we're going to move on to actually the reason we got invited to talk today, but we really wanted to give you kind of a background because our results and our papers are kind of getting coming out in not necessarily a chronological order, which I'm sure many of you interventionists know how that happens. So what I'm going to present today is this paper that was selected for this webinar that maybe looks familiar if anyone has had a chance to peek at it, to think about the post-class evaluation. So the experiences of both the participants and the facilitators who engaged in those What Can I Eat classes. And this is the qualitative, really qualitative, multiple methods, a little bit evaluation of What Can I Eat. And so all of the folks who went through the classes in the intermediate group, and then all of the class facilitators at all five sites participated in this, this evaluation. And so we had post-class surveys where each patient or participant in the class filled out a little survey. after each class. So they had five classes. And then we also had, because this is the first time since we developed the curriculum that anyone had actually ever taught it. So we wanted feedback from the educators too on what was it like teaching these classes. And so we have surveys from the facilitators as well. And then we did focus groups via Zoom, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with, at the end of each cohort of classes, and also focus groups with the facilitators to understand their experiences. And so this was just the moderator guide for the folks that graduated or that were in the What Can I Eat program. That whole moderator guide is in the publication, which you have access to. So if you want access to how we interviewed folks, what questions we asked, you have access to that. And then we also had a separate facilitator guide for the people who taught the classes, the dietitians, the diabetes educators who actually taught the classes. And that also is in the publication that you have access to. And really, as the research and development team, we just wanted to know from the folks that were involved in the classes, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, what would they change, what was their experience, et cetera. That was the essence of what we were getting at here. And then, like I said, after each class, remember there's five classes in the What Can I Eat curriculum, each patient completed a quick little feedback survey, and there was a little fill in the short answer option to really, so we could understand what their experience was class to class, not just as the curriculum as a whole. And so this table is in the paper, but really we found that participants did report that the classes were enjoyable, very important to us. They found, they suggested the classes were culturally respectful, which was obviously an important factor for all the things Kelly talked about at the beginning of this talk. And that it was easily accessible online. That was, you know, kind of new. This was the beginning of COVID, before folks were really comfy using Zoom for all the things we use Zoom for now. And so back in 2021, using Zoom for, you know, diabetes education classes was not the norm. So that was important to us to hear how people had experienced accessing the internet. We had four key themes across the interviews, the focus group interviews. One of the first themes was that participants liked the classes, but they largely liked them because of the peer-to-peer interaction and peer-based support. So these classes have a lot of space for folks to learn from one another, folks who have type 2 diabetes, to share their stories, to share their experiences, which, going back to what Kelly shared about tailoring a program to meet the needs of a specific community, storytelling and sharing lived experience is really important in Native communities. And so the curriculum has lots of spaces for that, where the facilitator perhaps just gives a topic and then peers get to either pair up or be in groups of three to talk about their own experiences. And so you can see one little quote up here. So that socialization, the camaraderie. Now, we are well aware that this was during the dark days of COVID, where folks were really stuck at home. And so just being able to talk to peers in general, whether it be about diabetes or not, was maybe a highlight for a lot of folks who kind of had been staying at home for you know, almost a year at this point to stay safe from COVID. Another key theme was how to improve the online classes. Remember, we developed this never thinking it was going to be online, but then we had to pivot, like many of you, I'm sure, did with your programming. And so there was some concerns about, you know, some folks really liked the online classes. Some folks were a little concerned about equity and people they knew who, as Kelly explained, perhaps live back home on a reservation that maybe don't have access to the internet. You know, how would those folks ever get access to these classes? But they also did like the feeling of being safe. This again was during COVID. So that's what safe means on that third bullet in terms of COVID, and the convenience, right? Folks have kids, have transportation, have elders to care for. And as many of you know, I'm sure there is a level of convenience to having things available online. Another theme that came up, and it also came up in our needs assessment that Kelly shared those findings, is recommendation for best class facilitator. So we heard that the style of education is really important. There were unfortunately shared poor past experiences with dietitians. And I say unfortunately, because I am a dietitian, as I'm sure many of you on this webinar are, and we don't like to hear that, but it's, you know, we need honest feedback from the people we're trying to serve. They really want the facilitator to be someone who's well known in the community that may or may not be a dietitian. And they also would like a collaboration with a traditional foods expert or an elder, especially for the parts of the curriculum that focus on traditional foods. They didn't necessarily want, you know, kind of an outsider to be educating them on traditional foods in their community, which completely makes sense. So perhaps some team teaching, that's where the peer education can really come into play. Based on how to incorporate some of those healthful traditional foods. And then the last theme was just how to improve recruitment and retention. We always, as implementation scientists and as educators, love to hear from the priority audience, you know, how do we get more people to do this thing, to engage in this project, to engage in this program? So they thought, hybrid classes would help so that folks that wanted to participate online could. They thought that having a trusted recruiter would really make a big difference, that word of mouth is really important in a lot of their communities. They did think the online classes were a little long. The in-person classes are meant to be 90 minutes, which is a little long for really anyone to sit through a Zoom. And they really did like the class kits. Angela shared we had to ship everyone a big box of stuff to do the classes. And they liked kind of having that box of things shipped to them so they could really feel engaged. So some implications from these findings. So we know the literature absolutely supports that, not just among Native communities, but in general, peer-to-peer support in chronic disease management is known to help with patient outcomes. Employing a peer educator model, which I'm sure many of you use, whether you work with extension, whether you work through a promotora model, or just peer educators in general, can help with class recruitment, retention, and just relatability of lived experience. They thought that, and this was, again, maybe not novel today in 2024, but back in 2021, this idea of remote or Zoom classes was novel. This was new for a lot of communities, and folks really seemed to understand the benefits of it and to appreciate that. And then, of course, we got some feedback that has since helped us revise what can I eat and I think improve it. We did get to present this work at ADA Scientific Sessions. This is a published abstract that kind of goes along with the paper itself. That was exciting to get to share. And then just back to this timeline that Angela has shared a couple times. And so at the end of year three, or the middle of year three, the process and outcomes evaluation, this is what Angela and I just shared. And we did a bunch of program modifications and edits. And now we're down here in project year four through six, where we're doing another trial of the intervention, largely because we never did get to test it in person, which was the original intent. But, you know, COVID threw us for a loop. So that's where we are right now. And just wanted you guys to see the full breadth of the evolution of what can I eat. So where we're going next with this curriculum, again, right now we are testing it at one urban Indian clinic. This is a different location than the five on the map that we've showed you a couple of times from the current data set. We also included a food security resource. We wanted to think about how food insecurity impacts one's ability to actualize diabetes nutrition education. And so that is underway right now. And in late this year, we'll be done with that data collection. We also need to evaluate what can I eat in Alaska community. This was always intended to be for American Indian and Alaska Natives. And until this point, we haven't had an opportunity to evaluate it for Alaska Natives. And then we've gotten requests from community, which is where we want all of our ideas to originate, right? But we've gotten requests, could this program be used for youth? Could it be used for pre-diabetes in collaboration, for example, with a DPP program? And can it be used for women who have or had gestational diabetes? And so those are questions that community is asking, and we are, Kelly and Angela and I and our team are actively thinking about, you know, how could we best adapt the program itself so it best serves these audiences. And what can I eat, for those of you that are on the webinar or listening to this later, is available for at no charge. We're very grateful that the American Diabetes Association has partnered with this endeavor and offers the program at no charge. And so this email address here at the bottom, all you have to do is email and they will, they send you a little survey, and it's not a, it's just to get a little bit of information. It's not to weed people out or anything. Anyone can get access. We really want to know who's using the curriculum, because every once in a while we do have updates, and that way ADA can then send an email to everyone using the curriculum and say, hey, you know, we see you downloaded the curriculum, you know, 8 months ago. And since then there's been new changes, just to keep everyone up to date when things change as far as the standard of care guidance, for example. And that's me. That's my email, which I think you'll have these slides in case you have questions. So I'm going to stop sharing now so I can see. And then Kristen's going to pop back on, I think.
Yeah, thank you so much for your presentation. We do have a number of questions in the question answer box. If anyone has any more, please feel free to add them. So the first question is, can you share the changes you made in the curriculum so that people would be able to see them?
Changes we made. So changes we've made from like the original ADA's version of What Can I Eat to now our American Indian Alaskan Native version. Is that?
I believe so.
So the original American Diabetes Association What Can I Eat curriculum is also available online. I don't know that it's free of charge. I'm not sure about that. And it was always designed to have a dietitian be the teacher, the facilitator. So the moderator guide, the facilitator guide is not near as detailed as our version, but that's because we always thought that eventually we're going to need non-dietitians to be able to teach this, just for equity's sake, to get more access, because there's a lot of Native communities that don't have a dietitian. So that's one big difference. But it's, to share them side by side, it would take probably a full 24 hours to go through all the details. But I will say the original version did have in each class, a physical activity component, a mindful eating component, a didactic kind of, and then an interactive learning component. We held true to those different components, but they are adapted quite a bit. So it's almost like two different curriculum, to be honest. So nice. Sorry about that. Yeah.
No, and let us know if that didn't answer the question fully, Barbara. So the next question says, thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. This participant conducted a similar nutrition education course for Black women that had to be modified to be done via Zoom due to the pandemic. What are your high-level takeaways for researchers who will look to do similar types of work with other populations in the future?
I think that, again, we collected this data back in 2021, where this whole Zoom thing was like new for lots of people, right? And now I think there's pros and cons to it, certainly, not just for COVID safety, but also just for access. I think making sure that, you know, people's attention span, perhaps all of us, not just our patients, is a little bit shorter maybe on online. So our classes are definitely too long for Zoom. So that was kind of a take home. Also just being mindful of making sure everything was accessible and usable on a phone, like if that's all folks have is a phone. And so we had lots of patients in our program who had their phone kind of propped up, and that was their whole interface, and it worked fine for them. And I do think, you know, giving them something to have from the class. So they got this box, and then it was kind of segregated in like, this is your packet for class one, this is your packet for class two. So they kind of felt like they had this special thing that, you know, they open up their packet and then the instructor would say, okay, in your packet, you've got like two markers, a paper plate. This is going to answer that next arts-based activity, two pieces of construction paper, and, you know, all the things we'll need to engage in this class. And even though folks sure might have had markers at home and a paper plate at home, it was kind of nice to get that little, you know, feeling special, like you're included in this package.
Yeah. So I know what supplies they had. What would that art-based activity look like?
Yeah, so we got feedback in our needs assessment, actually, and Kelly certainly helped guide this as well. But in our needs assessment, when we talk to Native dietitians, Native diabetes educators, you know, they shared the same thing Kelly said, that folks like to lots of visual learning. And also for folks who maybe aren't very comfortable talking about themselves, like they don't like to talk in a group about themselves, if they have something like a drawing and they can talk about that drawing, it's kind of taking the attention off of them, but they're still talking about themselves. So for example, one of the drawing activities is part of a goal setting activity where you draw a vision of your healthiest self in 6 months from now, for example. So people could draw whatever they thought was healthy for them and then talk about that drawing without having to necessarily, you know, talk about me, for example. Kelly, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I think that's what Barbara was looking for, is like an example of what it was really related to, more the mindfulness and kind of that reflection type of section of the curriculum or that session. I did want to just make one mention when we're talking about the Zoom and the key takeaways. I think one of the key takeaways was not making people be on camera because of the backgrounds that they, you know, the settings they may be in, you know, may make them not participate or join. So not requiring them to be on camera, if you're looking at doing something like this online, just something to consider.
Yeah. And Paul, do we have time for one more question or do we need to wrap it up?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So one last question. So this person is curious about opportunities to collaborate with sourcing traditional foods from Native farmers and producers. Was there any effort within your project to source Native produced food items? And they're also interested in the importance of culturally relevant harvesting of edible foods and medicines, such as foraging, to sustain cultural resilience and culture as medicine.
So in this evaluation of what can I eat, no, we do, throughout the curriculum, we do talk about access to traditional foods, what traditional foods are. We also leave a lot of those as kind of placeholders, because as Kelly mentioned at the beginning of this talk, you know, traditional foods is not the same thing in Oklahoma as it is in Alaska, as it is in Maine, right? So we left those as, we didn't want to have just a, you know, a pan-Indian approach here. We want to appreciate that there's all these different cultures and regions. And the land and where folks are from is really important to their foodways. So we left that open to either the facilitator, the educator, the peers themselves to talk through. Kelly, do you want to add anything to that?
I had something and it just slipped my mind, but yeah, well, just this whole program didn't necessarily. We didn't try foods. There were no food demos. That kind of thing worked into the curriculum. So there wasn't really like hardcore tangible food involvement with the program. But like Sarah said, there's placeholders. Someone could invite a Native producer to come to a class to talk about traditional foods. Like that's definitely something that this program would allow the flexibility to do. So that, I mean, that would be, you know, some, that'd be a great idea. So yeah, so it not necessarily related to sourcing food.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this great presentation. And at this point, I'll hand it back to Paul.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you to all of our panelists today. And thank you for everyone who joined us. Just to close things out, again, please complete the survey that you'll receive when we end the session. be on the lookout for that email with today's recording, the handouts, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's webinar, check out the upcoming webinar section of the website and look at the future journal clubs that are coming up. With that, thank you all and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks,
Paul. Thank you.
Take care, everyone.